Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Amber Simo, brand manager for MultiPure. The Las Vegas-based water filtration company's nonprofit arm, the Pure Foundation, has launched a new Clean Water for Health program to support other nonprofits. Amber, thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So, for those who don't know, what exactly is MultiPure?
So MultiPure is a water filtration company. We offer filtration systems that connect to your kitchen sink and filter the water right from your tap.
And what prompted the creation of the Pure Foundation?
So the Pure Foundation, we wanted to be able to create a platform to be able to help nonprofits, particularly nonprofits that help children and families. We wanted to have a way to be able to give back to the community, and this seemed like the best way to be able to do that.
Nice. Okay. Now, what is the Clean Water for Health program all about?
So the Clean Water for Health is our in-kind donation program where we work with nonprofits. They can contact us and let us know that they're in need of water. So obviously everybody needs water. And for a lot of these nonprofits, they have a very strict budget. And so a lot of times when they're spending so much money on bottled water or getting water delivered to their facilities, you know, they don't have that money to go towards other programs. So we want to be able to offer free drinking water systems to these facilities so that they can use that money to put towards other programs for the kids and families that they serve. And so we donate free drinking water systems in their kitchens, in their suites, wherever they need them, and then they get free filters for life.
Nice. How do you choose which nonprofits get a system?
So right now, we've always just kind of worked with whoever contacts us. We look at, you know, what their mission is. And a lot of times it's just something that works very closely to what we do. So like I said, we work a lot with nonprofits that work with children and families. That's just something that's kind of very close to our hearts. So we really want to work with them and be able to give back in a way that, you know, to help these families. They're already dealing with so much with these children that are potentially dealing with, they have a compromised immune system. So we want to be able to help them. And that's one less thing that they have to worry about.
Yeah, definitely. So how can nonprofits get one of the water systems?
So right now we have a website. It's multipure.com/in-kind. And they can go to that website and it tells you all about our program and it has some pictures about some of the programs that we've done around the country, similar to this where we've worked with other nonprofits. And then there's an application there where they can tell us their need, they can tell us about their mission and how they fit into what we're doing, and we reach out to them and let them know what we would be willing to do.
Okay, awesome. So how could community members help out? Maybe if they're a volunteer for a nonprofit or just would like to help get the word out and help the program along.
So the Pure Foundation, you can do donations. We have customers who donate drinking water systems to the Pure Foundation so that we can do these donations to the nonprofits. And, you know, just getting the word out about, you know, telling people that if you know that somebody's in need of a drinking water system, just letting them know that we have this free program in place for them. There's no cost at all for these charities. So when we pick them, the installation is done for free. The filters are installed for free. The filters are free. There's no cost for them. So just being able to say, you know, we have somebody who can help you and getting that word out is just amazing.
Okay, so then the website that they would refer a nonprofit to or go to for more information is the same one, multipure.com/in-kind?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. So once again, that website, multipure.com/in-kind, that lets you know more about the Clean Water for Health in-kind donation program that's run by MultiPure's Pure Foundation, which is their nonprofit arm, the Pure Foundation. And this program is available for nonprofits who apply to receive one of these free water filtration systems along with free filters for life. So all of the information is right there at multipure.com/in-kind. And we've been speaking today with Amber Simo. She's the brand manager for MultiPure. And Amber, what an innovative program. I'm really glad you're here letting us know more about it, what you're doing to help other nonprofits in the community, because they do so much great work and anything that they can get help with is just so inspiring, especially, like you said, clean water, that's one of the basic things that everybody needs. So thank you so much for being here and telling us more about the Clean Water for Health program.
Oh, no, I'm happy to talk about it.
When a student lacks some of the most basic needs,
like food, clothing, and school supplies,
it can be challenging to even attend school.
It can be hard to study, tough to concentrate, impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue every day.
Out in the community, there are great resources for students, and we bring these resources directly to the students who need them most.
We work to ensure that they have everything they need to re-engage in learning in the classroom and at home,
including access to technology, learning materials,
and even emotional support.
By forging caring relationships with students and bringing communities of support to them,
our staff works to achieve equitable learning conditions so all kids can succeed in school and in life. And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
To learn more, visit communitiesinschools.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Scott Laganga, Executive Vice President of Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. A recent PhRMA Ipsos survey reveals that 91% of insured Americans support reforms to crack down on the abusive practices of pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, in order to ensure affordable access to medicines. Scott, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is PhRMA, or Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America?
So the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, we represent our country's leading innovative biopharmaceutical research companies. These are the ones that are laser focused on developing the most innovative medicines that transform lives and create a healthier world. And over the last decade, most importantly, our companies have invested more than $800 billion in the last 10 years in search of new treatments and cures and support nearly 5 million jobs across the United States.
And then what exactly are pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs?
So for context, a lot of people don't even understand that now more than ever, they're paying more for their prescriptions at the pharmacy counter. And that's because the system is very complicated and convoluted. And they don't know of these powerful middlemen that have enormous control over their choices and the costs in the system. And so these middlemen called pharmacy benefit managers, or we often hear the term PBMs, and the insurance companies that often own them, they're the ones that decide what medicine patient can get, even after the doctor prescribes it, the price they pay at the pharmacy counter for those medicines, and what hoops and ladders they have to jump through to get that medicine prescribed. So they have enormous control and power over the kind of choices we deal with each day at the pharmacy.
What exactly did your survey reveal about consumer thoughts on PBMs?
Yeah, it's important because we have a better understanding of what really matters to patients. Sometimes you hear that healthcare is a large issue or pharmaceuticals are a large issue. But what we hear a lot is the consternation that most patients are feeling around this country is about what they pay at the pharmacy counter itself. And so in Nevada specifically, we now 81% of adults agree that policymakers should focus on cracking down on the kind of abusive healthcare insurance and PBM practices that make it harder to get the medicine they need. And that's consistent across the country. And so more and more we understand that in order to deal with that concern and pain that patients are paying at the pharmacy counter, policymakers have a role to play to step up at both a state and a federal level to deal with these issues and help patients better afford their medicine.
Yeah. Now, 91% is a big percentage. I'm kind of surprised that that many people even know about PBMs, let alone want them better regulated. So what do you think is influencing this vast majority of people to say the same thing?
It's a great question, Heather. I think a lot of it is shared experience. All of us, whether or not it's for ourselves, a family member, as a caregiver, are helping people go through a healthcare system that we've seen become more and more complicated. And candidly, more and more costs are coming out of an individual's pocket to cover that system. And so I think the reason you see such significant numbers is because of that shared experience. And that's the reason that they are definitely looking for opportunities. And that's why we see this mounting pressure coming from across the country. You see it in the form of the Federal Trade Commission at the federal level, to Congress, to, I know within your own state legislature in the state of Nevada, this has been a very open and direct dialogue because of that shared experience by patients.
Interesting. Okay. Now, Congress is back in session. So what can be done at the federal level to address the ways that PBMs are affecting the price of medicine?
Yeah, so back to the scrutiny, since it's coming from all angles at this point, that there's a need for action, Congress has the latest opportunity and a very significant one. And so building on all of those different players and actors that I mentioned that are really looking under the hood of PBMs and the business model, it's clear reform is needed. There's right now in Congress overwhelming bipartisan support for reforms that fix the misaligned incentives in the system and lower costs for patients and employers. So, for example, they have an opportunity by the end of this year before a new Congress and new administration come in some policies that would bring more transparency to the system. We need to know what's going on in that black box and under the hood, making sure that these rebate dollars, the 50 cents of every dollar spent on prescription drugs is going to somebody else. Why? Where's it going? And why is it not going to a patient? And more importantly, these PBMs should be paid a flat fee for their service, as opposed to basing it off of the price of a medicine and on the back of a patient. And that's important because they shouldn't get paid more just because a product maybe is more expensive or costs more for certain disease areas. They should be paid a flat fee, just like any other service would provide.
Okay. And then when the state legislature comes back to the Capitol next year, what do you expect them to do about this issue?
Well, huge opportunity. I will tell you, I know that this discussion that's going on in the legislature has involved PBMs and pretty significantly. I think they have a real opportunity as the laboratories of democracy to drive this agenda. Congress will debate it. There's certainly going to be an opportunity, but states can play a very leading role in moving some of these reforms, as we've seen across the country. For instance, you have three states that have already passed laws that pass the rebate dollars back to patients to make sure that they have those dollars. You have 21 states that have taken on the ways PBMs game the system to ensure that patient assistance support goes back to the patients who need it and not to the PBMs themselves. And there's a series of other ideas. There is a real opportunity at this point to not just listen to the needs of Nevada residents and patients, but to actually deliver some reforms out of the legislature come next year.
Scott, where can our listeners go to learn more about this issue and what they can do to make a difference?
Yeah, we welcome. They should visit www.phrma.org/PBMs.
Perfect. Okay. So once again, pharma.org/PBMs, that's spelt without the first A, phrma.org/PBMs. You can learn more about the issue of pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs. And we've been speaking today with Scott LaGanga. He's the Executive Vice President of Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or Pharma. And Scott, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing this issue, sharing what can be done about it and what consumers are feeling. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Charlie died after taking a single pill that turned out to be counterfeit.
He was having back issues and it was a counterfeit poisonous pill.
Websites and social media selling fake medicines may look legitimate, but they're not. Drugs from these rogue pharmacies could have fillers like sawdust or deadly fentanyl.
He died in less than 15 minutes after taking the pill.
Now there's a free tool that can give you peace of mind. At safe.pharmacy, enter the pharmacy web address and you'll know if the site you're using is safe.
If you're not getting your prescriptions from a legitimate source, that next dose you take could be your last.
We just don't want other people to go through what we're going through. It's just horrific.
Go to safe.pharmacy. Find out about fake medicine on social media and if the site you're buying from is safe.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Robert A. Wynn, director of the Robert A. Wynn Inclusion in Clinical Trials Award Program and director of Virginia Commonwealth University's Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center, and Catherine Grimes, president of the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation. Clinical trials are often heavily biased toward white Americans, and more diversity would lead to results that better reflect the real-world population. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
So, Dr. Nguyen, what is the Robert A. Nguyen Inclusion in Clinical Trials Award Program all about?
It's a big, bold ideal of solving the problem that you just mentioned at the top of the show. How do we get people to benefit from the science? Two things are true. We have more people living with cancer than dying from it, a direct result, by the way, of clinical trials. And the second one is, unfortunately, when you look at rural populations or urban underserved at-risk populations, they're not benefiting from the trials. And I like to say that when you've reached the end of the standard of care in the 21st century is to really to offer people trials. That, too, is an extension of care in the way we see it these days.
Yeah. So then how are participants typically recruited and selected for most clinical trials?
So the best about this is that it's a national search. So we have people all the way from the West Coast to the East Coast and everything in between. They're chosen on two characteristics. One, do they actually have a rigorous level of science? Because it begins and ends there. Number two, do they have a really good idea of how potentially to get the science to the community? That's the foundation of this. And so we have a group, a national advisory council that goes from everywhere. We have people from West and from East, and we have people from the NIH, and we have people from, we have people from everywhere that look at this very competitive field of scholars and whittled it down to the 50 that we take every year. And it's been a wonderful process.
Catherine, we've touched on it briefly, but why is diversity and inclusion of all people so important in clinical trials?
Yeah, Heather, you know, at the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation, our mission is to improve global health. And we really believe that improving representation in clinical trials is a critical part of advancing global health, ensuring that new treatments are safe and effective for everyone. And that is really why, that's at the root of why we established the WIN Awards program in 2020. This firm belief that trial participation really should resemble the people who are most likely to get the disease being studied. And right now, that's not happening. So this program really was built directly to address that problem.
Okay, so then what changes need to be implemented in order to correct this problem on a larger scale?
I think, well, the larger scale is that this is what was happening. We had people who could come up with the trials, but didn't know about community. We had people doing outreach and engagement in community, but had no idea about how to get a molecule to a medicine and how difficult that was. So in the United States, we were missing the workforce, i.e. the quarterback that would be able to, for example, in Nevada, be able to get the miracle molecule that became the medicine out into clinical trials so that the rural areas of Nevada and some of the at-risk areas of Nevada would be served as much as any big city. So what we've done in the scalability of this is that we now have people who are able to not only design trials and understand the science of outreach and engagement, but by putting those two together, they've been able to be a multiplying factor within their institutions. And so it's like a stochastic reaction. One of them leads to the other and it leads to more. And so we believe that hopefully in the next 10 years that we will have more people getting access in places like Nevada, in rural places and in at-risk places across the United States.
From our perspective, we really identified several key barriers that were preventing physicians who are underrepresented in medicine, particularly Black and Latino physicians, from engaging in clinical research. And to address these barriers, we designed this program aimed directly at overcoming them. So the four barriers that we identified were lack of resources, mentorship, protected time, and limited access to clinical trials networks. So the WIN Award program is really directly addressing these challenges. First, we require the scholars to apply with a mentor, and then we bring additional mentors into the program. We're offering protected time grants rather than research grants and creating a built-in network through training over 300 physicians over the 5 years. Really, to our knowledge, there's no other training program as systematically trying to overcome these specific barriers that are keeping early stage investigator physicians who are underrepresented in medicine out of clinical research.
And then how are recipients of the Robert A. Nguyen Inclusion in Clinical Trials Award selected?
Oh, that's been the most fun part. That's the hardest part, too. So there's a number of us. I mean, there is a panel of people, of physicians, of clinical trialists, of other people who get together, and we have to go over this competitive pool. We select them on a couple different things. One, do they have the rigor of science? Two, do they actually have the right model or the right project? But you know what? It's really hard because we also pick them on their passion. their drive and their persistence and their sense of compassion and a drive to really help the community. And that's, you know, you can imagine that we have had to, in this program, turn some really good people away. What I will say is that even those people who get turned away, we usually help them out so that they can reapply. So it's not all is lost, but we have a very competitive pool. We are getting a better pool every year, and it is tough picking these wonderful people.
Who are some of the recipients?
We have people. So here's what I really love to say is that we have people from places like Morehouse. We have people from places like MD Anderson and the Memorial Sloan to the John Hopkins. But we also have people from places like Montana and other places throughout the United States. So they're typically young, junior faculty. They still have the energy and the twinkle in their eye, who are being given the opportunity to have protected time at their institutions to be involved in this program, to be the leaders of tomorrow.
Nice.
I would just add to that, that broadly, the categories of research right now that are included in the program are early stage investigator physician researchers in cancer. That includes both hematology and oncology, as well as cardiovascular diseases and immune modulated diseases. So that's the research areas of focus in the program.
Okay, awesome. So how can listeners learn more about diversity in clinical trials and the Robert A. Wynn Inclusion in Clinical Trials Award?
I would encourage them to go to our website. It's super easy, diversityinclinicaltrials.org, and it's good timing. We're going to be opening recruitment for our fifth cohort of scholars in January.
Perfect. Okay. So once again, that website is diversityinclinicaltrials.org, diversityinclinicaltrials.org, and you can find out all about the Robert A. Wynn Inclusion in Clinical Trials Award and why it's important to have more diversity in clinical trials across the nation. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Robert A. Wynn. He's the director of the Robert A. Wynn Inclusion in Clinical Trials Award Program, and also Catherine Grimes, president of the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation. And it's been great talking to you both. This is an important issue. I'm glad you're out there doing something about it and letting us know more about it as well. It's been fantastic talking to you both. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Cancer can feel like something we can't do anything about. But you can. There are screening tests that can catch cancer early when it may be easier to treat. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, start colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get-screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
Federal guidelines have nearly doubled the number of Americans eligible for lung cancer screening. Insurance companies are required to cover these tests for those ages 50 to 80 who currently smoke or used to smoke. Along with new treatments, lung cancer screening saves lives. If you are 50 to 80 years old and smoke or used to smoke, talk to your doctor about lung cancer screening. For more information and to find a screening center near you, visit acr.org/mylcs. That's acr.org/mylcs.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Samantha Banerjee, Executive Director of Push for Empowered Pregnancy. The organization's Stillness is an Illness campaign explores the critical impact of potentially life-changing decisions during pregnancy. Samantha, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Heather, for having me and for helping us raise awareness of stillbirth.
So what exactly is Push for Empowered Pregnancy?
So PUSH is a national nonprofit. We are at this point entirely volunteer run, and we are founded by parents like me who lost a child to a potentially preventable stillbirth. So stillbirth is the death of a baby in the second half of pregnancy, and that baby needs to be born just like any other. And this is an issue which is very seldom talked about. And most of us who've been through this had no idea that it was happening to anyone in this day and age, let alone to us, let alone to, apparently, the CDC numbers show about 65 families every single day in the United States.
Wow, that's high.
It is. It's much higher than most people, and even medical professionals realize. You know, the average obstetrician maybe sees like one or two of these a year. And so it feels like, oh, this is like terrible. It's just one of those things. There's nothing you can do about it. But if you take a step back and look at the big picture, stillbirth is actually claiming more children's lives per CDC data up to age 14 than prematurity, SIDS, car accidents, drowning, guns, fire, poison, flu, and listeria combined.
Wow. All right. Now, speaking of letting people know more about this issue, what's your Stillness is an Illness campaign?
So we're really excited to launch this campaign with our partners at Cobase. This is intended to, it's a three-part campaign starting with general awareness built around a new short film called Push. It's only about 7 minutes running time, and it walks you through from the point of view of a family in the third trimester, you know, some critical decisions that both they and their providers are making, which will impact the outcome of their pregnancy. And our hope is that we can get as many people as possible to watch this and understand that if you notice stillness in your baby, you know, the movement's slowing down, the movement's getting weaker, or really any changes to fetal movement. It could even be a sudden kind of frantic feeling increase, burst of movement, that should be treated just like any other symptom of illness. So the same way if you had a sudden high fever, if you were suddenly very nauseous, like you would call your doctor and say, hey, this is going on, and they would say, oh, come right in. We want to check you out and make sure everything's okay. For some reason, that does not happen today when it comes to changes in fetal movement. And so that's what the campaign and the film center are on.
Nice. Okay. Now, how often are stillbirths preventable?
So there is research showing that very conservatively, we know at minimum 1 in 4 stillbirths in the United States are preventable today using, you know, the current tools and technology we have. And that includes 47% of stillbirths at term. That's at 37 weeks or later. For example, my daughter, who was born still 2 days before her due date. That said, there's still a lot more room for improvement. If we looked at our, you know, international counterparts, the U.S. actually ranks 48th out of 49 high-income countries in average rate of reduction of stillbirth over the past 20 years. And if we matched the rates of our best international peers, we would be preventing up to 75% of U.S. stillbirths. Literally, you know, tens of thousands of children every year that should be coming home from the hospital with their families and are not right now.
Yeah. Now, just to clarify, what's the difference between a stillbirth and a miscarriage?
The only difference is time. So a miscarriage is defined in the U.S. as any loss before 20 weeks, which is the halfway point of pregnancy. And a stillbirth is defined as 20 weeks all the way up through labor. And, you know, in terms of the grief, you know, it is very much the same. But from a physical standpoint, you know, stillbirths, because of the baby is big enough by that point that it still needs to be born, in most cases by a vaginal or a cesarean birth, there's a lot more physical trauma that happens to the mother's body. And so what we see is that moms who've had a stillbirth are almost 5 times as likely to suffer severe maternal complications that can potentially be life-threatening.
Oh, okay. Now, you mentioned some things that healthcare professionals could do to prevent more stillbirths, but what can pregnant women do to improve the chances of a healthy birth?
The main thing we always tell families is to know your normal. You know your baby and your body better than anyone. And so you should be on the lookout for, you know, getting to know your baby's fetal movements. We always say movements matter. Know what times of day your baby's active, how long it typically takes them to, you know, get to 10 kicks, what kind of stimuli they respond to. Because in many cases, fetal movement is the first or sometimes only warning sign that something is going on and that needs to be checked out. And so that's always the first thing is, you know your normal. And if you have any concerns, whether about fetal movement or anything else, always ask and don't wait. You know, so many of us carry regrets because we noticed something, you know, and then we, you know, saw misinformation online saying, oh, this is normal for babies to slow down at the end of pregnancy. You know, that is not backed up by evidence and it's a widespread and dangerous myth. And so we waited until, you know, we had an appointment the next day or, you know, we had an appointment 2 days later, or just didn't want to come in overnight because we thought we were being, you know, overreacting. But what actually happened was we missed the window of opportunity when we might have been able to intervene. You know, not every stillbirth is preventable. I think that's important to recognize. Just like all of those other common childhood risks, like SIDS and car accidents and drowning, you know, there are things that you can do to lower your risk, but sometimes accidents happen and, you know, they can happen quickly. The difference, though, is that right now, no one is equipping parents with the knowledge or tools they need to know that they lowered those risks as much as they and their providers possibly could have. And so, you know, we are walking around with a lot of excruciating what ifs. And so our goal as PUSH is to make sure that other parents are empowered with the information we wish somebody had given us so that we would know that we did everything in our power to prevent a tragedy. And the point of this campaign in its later phases is to make sure that our providers can say the same, because right now they are not getting the guidance and tools that they need to respond appropriately to concerns that parents bring to them. And that is the other critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Now, where can listeners go for more information about preventing stillbirths or to watch the Stillness is an Illness short film?
So you can find links to everything from our website, pushpregnancy.org. There we have our Empowered Pregnancy resources, which are always free and, you know, link out to all of the evidence that they are based on. There's reminder tip cards for expectant families, that kind of thing. If you want to watch the film in particular, you can go directly to stillnessisanillness.com. And it's right there. You just click the watch film button and you can check it out. We encourage people to please share that with anybody you know who should watch it, especially those in the medical field. And we just, again, the number one takeaway is if you or anyone you know is pregnant and they are noticing they have any concerns, the response should always be, just go get it checked out. It's better to get checked out. We need to trust women's intuition. We need to trust that parents know their babies and their bodies best, and that begins during pregnancy. And we need to empower them to speak up for themselves, because unfortunately, that is the reality of the system we live in. If you don't advocate for yourself, you won't get the care you deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So once again, those websites, pushpregnancy.org is the main website for PUSH. pushpregnancy.org. You can find plenty of empowered pregnancy resources there, tip cards, all kinds of information about preventing stillbirths and having an empowered pregnancy. And then if you'd like to watch the short film, stillnessisanillness.com will take you straight there. stillnessisanillness.com, a very powerful 7-minute short film that's definitely worth taking a look at. stillnessisanillness.com. And we've been speaking today with Samantha Banerjee. She's the executive director of PUSH for Empowered Pregnancy. And Samantha, I really appreciate you being here and bringing to light this issue that, as you mentioned, not a lot of people talk about. I think not a lot of people know about. The numbers that you quoted were a surprise to me. So it's really great that you're out here raising awareness about this issue. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here with you.
You know what hope is? Hope is action. Carving a path forward, even when it's hard.
And kids who still know how to dream. They're the best pathfinders of all.
So at Child Fund, hope means helping millions of children living in poverty worldwide to grow up healthy, educated, skilled, and so all those good things can come true for them. Safe.
And that means safe at home, safe at school, and safe online.
Hope means walking this path together, all of us. Because when we work together, we can do so much more.
That's right. Hope includes you.
Child Fund, because we need each other.
To learn how Child Fund works with children in 23 countries to help them achieve their full potential, visit childfund.org. That's childfund.org.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Rod Griffin, Senior Director of Consumer Education and Advocacy for Experian. This weekend officially kicks off the holiday shopping season, and the annual Experian Holiday Shopping Survey reveals some insights about consumer attitude this year. Rod, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, Heather, thanks for having me.
So what are some of the key insights revealed by this year's Experian Holiday Shopping Survey?
Well, it starts with stress. 33% of people told us that they get stressed just thinking about holiday shopping. I think the other 67% probably just haven't started thinking about it yet, maybe, because it's always a little bit stressful. Almost 90% said that they're tempted to spend more than they should during the holiday season. So getting into overspending can carry over into the new year, and that's exactly what we don't want to happen. I think that's really kind of one of the key findings is how do we resist that temptation to spend more than we should?
Yeah. What makes the holiday season so tempting to overspend?
The people we love, we really want to make the people we love happy. And getting gifts that we know are going to bring them joy, we'll see them smile. You know, I think about my kids when they were little and getting a gift and dancing in the living room. You know, it's always easy to overspend. And when we see those sale signs, or if we're online shopping with Cyber Monday or the Black Friday deals, it's really tempting to spend when we see those sale signs and make those impulse buys. And that impulse purchasing is what really gets people into trouble.
Yeah, definitely. What types of things are shoppers the most likely to bust their budget on?
Gifts for other people. That's first and foremost. We're not so much spending on ourselves. It's about getting things for other people. They get things that are on sale. I mean, that sale price looks fantastic. You know, 20% off, 30% off, 50% off. And it's really tempting to spend the money just on impulse. 90% of people told us that they're tempted to purchase items that they're not shopping for. And so it's important to really have a budget, which we hate that word, but we need to know where our money's going, where it's coming from. We need to make sure that we're controlling our money and it's not controlling us. So, you know, have a budget and then make a list. So people act like Santa, make a list, check it twice. And when you're shopping, have it with you. And when you see those sale signs, you can look back at your list and say, yeah, I'm tempted, but no, it's not on my list. I need to stick to the budget. And that can be a really powerful tool.
Yeah. So is the list the ultimate savior for sticking to a budget? Or do you have other tips for managing a budget while still checking off the virtual boxes on our holiday to-do list, still getting gifts for everyone, still putting on those holiday dinners, those feasts, those get-togethers?
Well, a budget and a list is a starting point. There's something we hear talked about now called loud budgeting. Basically, what that means is you set a budget and then you tell people about it. You tell the people that you're planning to spend the holidays with that you have to stick to a budget. Inflation's kind of pinching most of us and making it harder to shop. So if you tell people, look, I have to control my spending and let them know where you are, quite often you'll find that they're in the same place and it makes it much easier to kind of set spending limits for everyone, put together a plan for how you're going to give and help everybody reduce cost. So talk about it. I think that's important. The other thing is to look for ways to save money and reduce your expenses as a whole. Almost half of people told us that they plan to use credit cards to make their purchases this year. If you're going to do that, you should also be taking advantage of what I think of as credit as a financial tool. You should be looking for things like cash back or discounts on purchases, or if you're planning to travel, maybe it's airline miles. Look for those incentives. If you don't have a card that gives you a financial advantage, you might want to shop for one. And Experian has a marketplace on our website at Experian.com. You tell us what you're looking for, and we can help match you to a credit card that meets those criteria and perhaps be able to save some additionally during the holidays to help you meet that budget. We also have something called a no ding decline feature that if you see a card with that label, it means that you can apply. And if you're not approved, it's not going to hurt your credit scores or your credit report. So it's a good way to shop for one or two new cards that might be able to reduce your costs by maybe giving you savings at the stores you're shopping at most. So take advantage of financial tools that maybe you wouldn't otherwise think of. As long as you're paying that balance full at the end of the billing period, paying it off and not paying interest, you'll save money. And that's really what credit's about. Credit's a financial tool. That's the financial problem.
Yeah. Now, of course, paying off the full card balance is a struggle for some people, especially if they're using that credit card to fulfill their desire to get, gifts for loved ones, like we talked about. So what are some tips for managing that growing debt if it does happen to start snowballing out of control?
Yeah. And, you know, it's, again, it goes to having a plan. A budget's a roadmap. It's not a barrier. So if you have a budget, you need to control your money, not let it control you and know where it's going. From there, it's about understanding if you use credit to make a purchase and you're taking on debt, you're going to need to delay a purchase or perhaps not make another purchase until you've paid off that debt. And then it's small steps. It takes time to take on those high balances. It will take some time to pay them down. Pick a card that has, if it's credit card debt, especially if it's a, you know, a low balance and you can pay it off more quickly, perhaps you start there, pay it off, take what you were making those payments for on that card and put them toward the next card and pay them down. Or the math says is if you start with the highest interest rate credit card, pay it off first and then kind of create an avalanche of payment from there. But you know, I always tell people math doesn't always account for the rest of our lives. It's never wrong, but it's not always completely right either. If you're not making progress and it becomes frustrating, you don't feel like you're getting the debts paid off, then the math isn't going to matter. So do what works for you, but start small. Make sure you're making your payments on time on your other accounts and then make more than the minimum on at least one of them. And that way you'll maintain current payments on all of them and reduce at least one. And over time, you'll be able to reduce that debt. It can just take patience and persistence, perseverance.
Yeah. Fantastic advice. So where can listeners go to learn more about budgeting during the holidays or even see the holiday survey results?
Go to Experian.com. You'll find lots of great information, free financial education tools. You'll also find our marketplace there. So if you're shopping for a credit card, you'll be able to see if maybe there's one that will work better for you and take advantage of the no ding decline feature. And there are other tools there as well. Insurance, for example, auto insurance is high. We're traveling during the holidays. Our auto insurance marketplace, we find that on average, people save about $800 a year. And as a result, maybe you can put some more money toward those gifts or perhaps in your gas tank to travel a bit further. But look for ways to save money in other places that you might not have otherwise thought of and might make your holiday season a bit brighter.
Yeah, awesome. Okay. So once again, that website is Experian.com. Of course, Experian is one of the major credit bureaus. Experian.com. You can find plenty of tips and see the holiday survey results there as well. And we've been speaking today with Rod Griffin. He's the Senior Director of Consumer Education and Advocacy for Experian. And Rod, some fantastic advice you've given today, some great insights into what other consumers are thinking and doing during the holiday. And I really want to thank you for being here and sharing this important information with us. So thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you.
Click this link now to review my bank transfer. I didn't make a bank transfer. Ugh, another phishing message. Are you frustrated by these too? So much of our lives are online today. To make sure my information is protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World resources. They've got four simple ways we can stay safe online. First, learn to recognize and report phishing. Next, create a strong, unique password for each online account and use a password manager if you can. Then turn on multi-factor authentication for extra security and you'll receive a code when logging in. And finally, turn on automatic software updates for convenience and safety. Click here to track my delivery. Another phishing message. But now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at cisa.gov/secureourworld for more quick, easy tips to be safer online.
This is McGruff the Crime Dog, and I need you to help me take a bite out of crime. Counterfeit products are popping up everywhere. Fake sneakers, fake cosmetics, and even fake pills. Crooks are selling counterfeit versions of just about everything. Last year, billions of dollars worth of counterfeit products were sold in the U.S. Sure, it may seem like saving a few bucks on the things you want isn't a big deal, but counterfeits are usually made in unsafe conditions, potentially using hazardous and even lethal ingredients that could harm you and others. And the money you've paid, it goes right into the hands of criminals and may support child labor, drugs, and even gangs. Smells like big crime to me. So if you still think buying fake products is harmless, think again. And remember, if you don't know where the products came from, how could you know where the money goes? You're smart. Buy smart. Go for real. Learn more at McGruffPSA.org. This message is brought to you by the United States Patent and Trademark Office and the National Crime Prevention Council.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Melissa Foley, founder of Hopscotch Girls Presents. Her new Hopscotch Girls book series recognizes the need for children to develop a strong foundation in financial literacy and includes the titles Mia Madison, CEO, and The Pop-Up Shop Predicament. But a recent survey found that financial concerns are the most significant source of strain during the holiday season for adults as well. So Melissa also has some easy ways to be a positive role model for kids instead of letting stress get in the way. Melissa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what inspired you to write your new Hopscotch Girls books?
So we started out creating books for girls that were activity books. So I got my start doing coloring books and sticker books and that kind of thing. And this is our first time jumping into fiction. So Hopscotch Girls is all about building girls up and working towards a future with more women in positions of power. And that includes the boardroom. So we really just wanted to introduce girls to entrepreneurship in a way that's fun.
What age range are they written for?
This particular series is for girls and boys age 8 to 11. We have other activity books that are for kids from age 3 up.
Nice. Okay. Now, what kinds of important lessons do they teach kids?
So our books overall are all about building confidence and self-esteem. The Hopscotch Girls Presents fiction series is really kind of focused on this entrepreneurship angle. So we're just kind of planting the seed that even kids can have businesses because it turns out they can be so beneficial for kids. So even a business like a lemonade stand, babysitting, car washing, those kinds of things give kids an opportunity to practice being independent, experience leadership, and to learn about managing money.
That's fantastic because typically I find that financial literacy isn't really taught that much in school. So we need other ways to teach our kids about finances.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, nothing works better than them experiencing it themselves. And especially when they need to put money into their business and then they see what they get out and decide what to do with their hard-earned money.
Yeah. Now, speaking of finances, obviously it affects adults as well. What are some ways that we can better manage stress around finances, especially during the holiday season?
Well, you know, everyone likes to say it's the thought that counts. And I think there's definitely opportunity to look for gifts if you're wanting to give material gifts that are meaningful but won't break the bank, and they definitely exist. That's something, a gap that we try to fill with our products in particular for kids. So, you know, our books range from $6.99 and up. And so it's a way to give someone a gift that's meaningful, but really affordable.
And how can we be more positive role models for our kids while getting into the holiday spirit?
Kids are always watching us. And so we're role models, whether we like it or not. And so that's something that's really good to keep in mind. I think that for us parents, it's so common for us to get caught up in wanting to create this holiday magic that sometimes it gets a bit stressful for us. And I think it's a good reminder that kids pick up on that stuff too. So I'm always in favor of simplifying things and kind of prioritizing and making sure that everyone can enjoy the holidays together, not just the kids.
Yeah, for sure. Besides getting them your Hopscotch Girls books, how can we teach some financial strategies to our kids?
So, I mean, helping kids manage their money is a great place to start. So whether they've have birthday money left over, if they've earned it from their own kid business, helping kids figure out what to do with it can be really helpful. So if there's something that they've been wanting for a while, you can help your kid figure out, okay, how much money do you have? How much do you need to get this item? And then what are you going to do to fill the gap? That can be great. There's also some really helpful apps out there. My family uses the Greenlight app that allows me to kind of virtually, through the app, give my kids money when they earn it through chores and things like that. And they also have investment accounts that they've opened through the app. And so they practice saving their money and investing it even at a young age.
Yeah, that's great. Now, sometimes stress can lead to negative self-talk, which can lead to self-sabotage, both in ourselves and our kids. So how do we stop that cycle from happening?
It's hard. You know, it's hard to stop negative self-talk. there's a couple things that you can do. One of them is just to try to practice noticing it when you're doing it. Another thing that's been really successful for me is to be really conscious of how I'm talking to myself and think about if I'd be okay if my child was talking to herself that way. And if I wouldn't be okay with her doing it, then I'm not okay with me doing it. So that those are a couple things that I've found really helpful.
Yeah, for sure. Now, if there was one key message that you would like to give to kids this holiday season, what would it be?
I would love for kids to follow their passions and really, even though you're young, there's still opportunity to think about what you're really into and try to find a way to do it. I think, you know, starting a kid's business is one really fun way to do it. If you're into making friendship bracelets, like, hey, maybe that's a business. If you like animals, you could do pet sitting. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. What are some other tried and true beginning entrepreneurial things that kids can do?
I think when kids are really first starting out, they might not be ready to start an actual like kid business themselves. So one of the first things they could do is just with parents' help, what are some chores that they could do? So within their family, ways to earn money for specific jobs. That's an easy thing to do. The next level up is some kind of kid business that's like a one-off. You know, there's no ongoing obligation. So stands are great. You know, a lot of kids love to just put up a table in front of their house and sell lemonade in the summer. That kind of thing is a good way to get started. And then, of course, when they're more advanced, you know, if you've got a really ambitious kid, that might be the kid that wants to, you know, start their pet sitting business and things like that.
Awesome. Okay, so where can people find out more about financial literacy for kids or even get a copy of one of your Hopscotch Girl books?
So the fiction series is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and at hopscotchgirls.com. And at our website, we also have resources for kids that are wanting to start their own kid businesses. So if they're not quite sure what kind of business they would want to do, we've got a tool that can help them figure that out. If they have an idea for a business, we've got a tool that can help them map it out and figure out how to market it and all that.
Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, so once again, the Hopscotch Girls Presents books can be found at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and also at the website hopscotchgirls.com. Now, the benefit of going to hopscotchgirls.com is you can also access resources for kids, financial literacy, starting a kid business, all of the kinds of stuff that we've been talking about today, hopscotchgirls.com. And we've been speaking today with Melissa Foley. She's the founder of Hopscotch Girls Presents. And Melissa, it's been great talking to you, getting some tips for the kids, for financial literacy, for stepping out on their own, gaining that independence, and dealing with stress during the holiday season that can often come with finances. So thank you so much for your time and talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Teachers are dynamic leaders, shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Achieving this takes skill and expertise. They're tireless explorers, creatively discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, experimenting, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, and connecting with each other. Leading by example. Experience the unique joy of helping students thrive. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready to begin? Explore teaching at teach.org, a campaign supported by the U.S. Department of Education, teach.org, and 1 million teachers of color.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Giving Tuesday is this Tuesday, December 3rd. This global generosity movement encourages people to give and do good, whether that's volunteering your time, donating to a nonprofit, or engaging in random acts of kindness. You can contact your favorite charity or find out more at givingtuesday.org. That's givingtuesday.org. The annual Las Vegas Great Santa Run to support Opportunity Village is happening next Saturday, December 7th, with registration and Santa suit pickup at 8 a.m., pre-race festivities at 9 a.m., and the race at 10 a.m. at the downtown Las Vegas Events Center, 200 South 3rd Street. 5K or 1 mile options are available, and the event is stroller, wheelchair, walker, and pet friendly. Register or find out more at opportunityvillage.org. That's opportunityvillage.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party for various local charities. Their 11th anniversary celebration is happening on Monday, December 9th, with doors at 7 p.m. and show at 8 p.m. in the Pearl Concert Theater at the Palms Casino Resort. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And Signs of Hope's annual Night Out fundraising event with a Hope for the Holidays theme is taking place on Wednesday, December 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. inside the Opium Room at Town Nightclub in the Venetian Resort, 3377 South Las Vegas Boulevard. This year, the nonprofit is honoring community partners that provide vital support to the organization and its mission of providing help, hope, and healing to those affected by sexual violence. Get your tickets or find out more at sohlv.org. That stands for Signs of Hope Las Vegas, sohlv.org.